Hello, I'm Rob Howell. Welcome to this episode of the Parrot Dressage Podcast. I'm really happy this week to be talking to a parrot dressage rider who represents Ireland on the international scene. So it's really great. So we've not spoken to anyone from Ireland before. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Tamsin Addison. Tamsin, hello and welcome to the Parrot Dressage Podcast.
Hello, it's an absolute delight to be part of it. Thank you for inviting me.
No, it's really good to have you here because I know that your background, the reason I've asked Tamsin along this week is to talk about some, not just her career in para dressage and how she got involved in the sport, but Tamsin's really good at hints and tips about things like marketing yourself and getting relationships with your sponsorship, with your sponsors. She's also has a background in sports psychology, so we'll be talking about that as well. But before we get on to that, Tamsin, in the words of, I was going to say something really cheesy then, but who are you, where you're from? Can you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into para dressage?
Sure. I'm really a converted eventer. I was asked to ride a dressage stallion for a lady who was pregnant and was finding the horse a bit challenging. And that was really what converted me from eventing to proper grown-up dressage. But my trainer Stephen reminds me almost every week when I'm doing extended canter along the long side that I'm not supposed to be eventing now. It's extended canter, Tamsin, not gallop across a field. So you can take the girl out of eventing, but sometimes you can't take eventing out of the girl.
Oh, that's brilliant. When you were an eventer, was dressage something that you enjoyed, or was it the bit you had to get through before you got to do the cross country and the show jumping?
It was most definitely something that had to be tackled before I went cross country. Cross country has always been my strongest phase. And I think I've done some fairly exceptional dressage tests, but not in the spirit that I would like to do right now.
Yeah, excellent. So what was it about that horse that you rode that kind of turned you on to dressage then?
I think because I was always strong in the cross country phase, I always had horses which were good jumpers. And I hadn't really ever experienced sitting on a horse that was talented on the flat. And having a horse that could give you such a good feel that it made you really feel excited about doing the flat work is what changed me from wanting to event to doing dressage.
And when you do dressage now, are you doing it with joy?
Absolutely. There has to be something that gets you out of bed at 5 a.m. To go onto the yard, and I couldn't do it every day if I didn't really enjoy it. I love it. It's the other people do yoga or Pilates or mindfulness to get their head in the right space. For me, it's being able to ride the horse and either school or hack out and spend that time with the four-legged ones outside.
I think that's a really lovely answer because dressage is so much about that relationship between yourself and the horse. And it sounds from what you've said that you use the word mindfulness there about being in the moment, you and your companion animal. That must be really lovely for you.
It's a lot of hard work if you only enjoy the 6 minutes in the arena competing. You know, it's 6 or 7 minutes per test. And if you think about how much time and energy and how much of your life it soaks up, you have to enjoy the journey and enjoy everything that goes with it. Otherwise, it's just too much like hard work.
Hmm. That's really lovely. So let's talk a bit about your entry into para. What's the nature of your impairment? You're a grade 5 rider, aren't you?
I'm a grade 5 rider. I had a par osteosarcoma in my right arm, which meant that they had to take out 12 centimetres of bone between my elbow and my shoulder. And I decided that I wanted to keep the arm, fought very hard to keep my right arm, and I had experimental treatment to plug the gap, which involved going a completely new bone from the elbow up to my shoulder. Gosh. So it's a bit shorter than the other one now, but and my right hook isn't very good, but my left's pretty accurate. I do okay with it.
Excellent. And then just looking back on your para dressage career, I can see from the FEI database, it looks like you've been riding since about, where are we? I think I've got your first para dressage event back in 2013. But then last year you competed for Ireland at Rotterdam, which was your first big major international at the Europeans. What was that like for you as a rider?
It was absolutely fantastic. It was lovely to spend time with the team. It was a great event for me. I really enjoyed it. And it was, you know, it was a great achievement for Ireland because we had the show jumpers and the able-bodied dressage team there as well. And it was a first for Ireland because we'll have three Olympic disciplines represented in Tokyo as well as para. And in Rotterdam, the girls in green did really well and they qualified. So, you know, we partied like the proverbial Irish. You know, it was a great time. It was a lovely atmosphere. It was a great show, and we all really enjoyed it. It's wonderful.
And what did you learn as a competitor by being on a much much bigger stage like that?
I think I had the opportunity to practice some of the things that you don't always get to practice when you're at home in smaller competitions. I thrive on having the luxury of being able to focus on one horse for a week rather than having, you know, a yard and having to worry about all the horses. Being away from all of that and being in one place and focusing on one horse and how that horse is going and what you need to do to make it its absolute best all came together for me in Rotterdam. So it was a good competition and, you know, the team were brilliant and we'd had a busy year, so by that stage in the year, we'd ironed out a lot of the creases and things that weren't working as well.
Excellent, excellent. So let's move on to, you know, away from that kind of potted history and get into the meat of one of the reasons why I invited you on here. And I'm so pleased I'm so grateful that you accepted. But I'm always fascinated by sports psychology, and you are a qualified sports psychologist. And I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what attracted you to go and study that in the first place.
I've always been interested in psychology. I did a psychology A level. In fact, I left school at 16 so that I could ride and do psychology. And then I went on to study it at university and I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to do a PhD.
Right.
And doing the PhD in sports psychology was, you know, a natural thing for me because it was the bit I'm really interested in. I've always been into sports. I was better at sports than anything else at school. And for me, I think if you look at the history of how sports have adapted over the years, we've pushed the science, we've pushed the nutrition, and I think that the psychological aspect is one that's now coming into its own, whereas a few years ago, people didn't really think that having a sports psychologist was an essential part of your team. Having a strength and conditioning coach was, and having a nutritionalist is really important. But the psychology was always a nice to have icing on the cake. But I think people are starting to realise now just how powerful it can be.
Yeah. Have you got any examples in your own career where using some sports psychology techniques have really helped you or that you've seen help other people?
There was a point where I was trying to decide what to do between different competitions and what the best course of action was with regards to my horses. And I was really struggling with finding the right thing to do. And somebody who helps me a lot helped me focus on what I needed in terms of information to make that decision. And I didn't have the information I needed. And just making me aware that there is no decision to be made at the moment until you get to a certain point and you get the bits of information you need, the right answer is to do nothing. So while my mind was racing on revisiting the decision all the time, having someone actually make you think about just leaving it on the shelf until you have all the bits of information you need to make the right decision certainly stopped my mind from churning and allowed me to focus on things that I could influence at that point in time.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Sometimes the best thing to do is just nothing for a while.
And that's not something that comes particularly easy to me. I'm not a sort of sit back and do nothing thing. So it then becomes a very active thing. I am actively waiting until such and such a date when I get the piece of information, and then I will make the right decision.
But of course, psychology is, and particularly sports psychology, is not a one size fits all kind of technique, is it? There's no set rule. Howard, if I was a young up and coming rider at the start of my career, what advice would you give me in terms of how to use sports psychology, for example?
I think identifying the things that you want help with and what the best outcome for you is allows someone to help you with some tools and techniques to make it better. So that might be conquering nerves, or it might be looking at your focus of attention, but being very clear about what you want the outcomes to be. And that way you can get the right tools to make the situation better and to practice them. And it's like anything, you need to practice the tools and the techniques in order for them to become part of your routine and to be part of the way you successfully compete.
Absolutely. And we were talking earlier before we started recording about the different types of techniques that are available, because it's very easy to think that it would be, you know, you just, you know, so before you go into arena, just practice a bit of mindfulness, for example. But that isn't necessarily the case, is it? It could be that some people like peace and quiet. Some people like a bit of fuss and activity before they go into arena. Where do you stand on that front? What are you like in those final seconds before it's your time to go and perform your freestyle?
It starts a lot earlier than a few minutes before. About an hour before my test,
yep.
I choose to bring myself away from the hubbub and all the friends and acquaintances in the para world and try and find a quiet spot for myself. And between there and going into the arena, I prefer not to have conversations with anybody really, except for my coach, Stephen, and my groom, Tim. So
right.
I don't want other people interfering with, you know, what's going on in the yard or how other people have got on, because I need to focus my mind and think quietly about what I'm going to try and achieve and what I need to practice. So I might go and have a quiet, cup of tea in the lorry, or if I've not got the lorry at a competition, I might just be quietly in the stable, thinking about the test and which bits I'm going to focus on, rather than being around lots of people. I prefer quiet, but I know other people have very set routines. So for mm-hmm. some people, I think it's really helpful to have lots of things to do, so that they don't have mind talk, which interferes with demoralizing them and thinking about what might go wrong. So they might be very active in getting the horse tacked up or checking the plats or thinking about how they're going to get from the stable to the arena. Whereas I prefer to be much quieter. And in fact, there's quite a well-documented case. I think it was a famous eventer who first started the vogue for having darkened glass in your lorry so she could go and be quiet and people wouldn't see her through the windows when she was trying to be quiet before she started competing.
It's fascinating, isn't it? So when you watch sports yourself, do you notice, can you see people using kind of their own individual tricks and techniques before they race? I think, for example, when you watch Michael Phelps, for example, come out for a race, he's always got his hood up and his earphones, his headphones on and stuff like that. Can you see people and think, they're doing this, for example?
Yes, but it's easier if you know them really well, because you know what's going to work for them. So, you know, one of my teammates I know also likes to be quiet. So the last thing I'm going to go and do is go and say, oh, good luck, hope it goes really well, just before he goes in, because I know that he's focusing and thinking and he doesn't need to know that I wish him good luck. There are other people that do much better if you say, you know, that's looking really good. Good luck. I'll be thinking of you and I'll be watching from A and I won't forget to video it. And they feel that you're partly there for them and thinking about them and willing them through every step of the test.
Yep. Is it easy to pick up people's cues for things like that?
Again, I think it's an individual thing. Some people will tell you. And other people, I think you need to read quite carefully. So, and if I'm not sure, I will say to someone, is there anything I can do before you go in? Or that I can do to help, or would you prefer me to stay away?
Yeah. And that's a really nice tip, isn't it, to use if you're on a team and you're new to a team, is just never be afraid to ask those kind of questions.
Well, it's difficult because everybody reacts differently. And yep. Overload for me is just too much because I tend to have quite a busy mind anyway.
Yeah.
For other people, you know, that's vital that they don't feel abandoned at the last minute by everybody being quiet and saying nothing.
And if I was in the process of setting up a relationship with a new sports psychologist, is there anything I have to do in advance, or is it easier just to go in with a completely blank piece of paper and an open mind and just start the conversation with him or her?
A good sports psychologist will help you come to the meeting with the right questions. So probably doing a bit of homework first and thinking about what's worked really well for you and what hasn't worked well for you, so that they can work through with you what the signals are that you need to watch for a positive or a negative impact. That's quite good. And also being very clear about what it is you want the psychologist to help you achieve.
Excellent. No, that's really useful and such good advice. You use your sports psychology training. Were you ever, I know that we'll talk in a minute about your successful marketing career, but were you ever actually a sports psychologist yourself with clients?
I've worked with the Irish rugby team. I've worked with elite triathletes. I'm currently doing some mentoring, so I'm currently working with a modern pentathlete. I've worked with the British wakeboard champion. And I really enjoy that active learning about a different sport, because we all get very hung up on what we do and you forget that actually there are lots of different impacts that you can have across different sports. So even if you look at the difference between equestrian sports, so polo, you need quite a broad attention span so that you can see the options and the spaces in the field to be able to play them well. And a show jumper will need a much more narrow focus of attention so that they don't get distracted by the crowd or the competitors coming into the ring while they're still finishing their last round. And I find that fascinating.
And have there been any tips and stuff that you've learned? I find it fascinating that someone who's at the top of their game in dressage can be working with a rugby team, for example. Are there any tips that cross over the sports?
Yeah, lots. I mean, it's not just sport either. I think, you know, what we do in the dressage arena is effectively a performance. So if you're an actor or a musician, you're still providing a performance. And so I think there's lots of crossovers between sports, but also between different disciplines. And, you know, actors and actresses have to perform and get over nerves as well.
Oh, it's fascinating. I love all this stuff. But let's talk about marketing. Let's talk about marketing. Because you went on to, you know, you've had a successful marketing career. Is there anything that you've taken from your marketing background and used in your sport as well, whether that's raising your own profile or building relationships with sponsors, for example?
I try. But obviously, you know, it's something I'm still learning about because it's a change being on the other side of marketing for me.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the more professional para dressage becomes, the more important it is. And, you know, it's something that not many of us think about in relation to our sport until you've started to build a bit of a profile for yourself. But, you know, it's an ongoing process and we all probably need to work a bit harder at it, certainly me. You know, I've got some really good sponsors, and one of the things that I try really hard to do for them is to work very hard for them. And by that, it's not just using their products. I don't think that's good enough anymore. I think you have to work much harder than that. And in order to do that, I think you have to really love the products. If you don't believe in them, it's really difficult to sell them. So I've got somebody who's probably going to offer me a sponsorship package in the next, I don't know, couple of months. Right. But I am wary about that because I'm not sure whether I can be effervescent and positive enough about the particular product, because I'm not sure that it's quite right for me. Whereas, you know, I'm sponsored by Pure Wood Pellets and I think they're brilliant. So it's easy to be passionate about them and to, you know, I give away free samples when I go to competitions because I want other riders to use them, because it's not until you use them that you realize that they're really good.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that comes back to that, I'm not sure it's a buzzword or such or not, but it's about authenticity, isn't it? It's about you as a person being true to who you are as yourself, isn't it? Not creating some false persona. It's about just being you.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. And I think that's the same with social media as well. So my Instagram and Facebook accounts have grown quite substantially over the last year and a bit, but they've grown organically. So it's grown from the point of view of people wanting to join and wanting to be part of the community and wanting to understand what's going on. But I won't say things or do things in order to grow the numbers. It has to be a group of like-minded people who are interested in what's going on rather than just growing the numbers so that there's a big number on my following.
And I think that's a really important point, isn't it? Social media in particular, you know, yes, numbers are important, but they're not the be-all and end-all, are they? You have to be, to attract a sponsor, for example, you have to be real and authentic in what you do on social media. It's not just about chasing numbers.
Exactly. I mean, and there are some very good examples of people who do it really well, and they're not necessarily the people with the big names. So, you know, I follow a lady called Flo Carter. She's a local inventor. She has a huge following, but she's very authentic, and, you know, she's very broad in what she talks about. And there's also a man on horse who I follow, and he has a very interesting point of view. He's very witty. And he donates to charity every time he gets a certain number of followers. So, you know, I think there are different ways of building your profile, but the most successful, in my view, are the ones who are very true to what they're trying to do.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, obviously, again, with your background and in the marketing industry, on branding? You obviously would have been involved in branding of companies. You've worked for some quite high profile brands. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on kind of personal branding or ways you can improve your own story, for example?
I think I probably need to work harder on my own brand, but I find it personally quite difficult because I'm quite a private person. So I don't find it particularly easy to share all the ups and downs on social media. But what I do say, I'm prepared to stand behind at every turn. So I will always respond when people ask a question, not always as quickly as I should do, but I do respond. And when people contact me and ask me to help out, so for example, a whole bunch of Irish nurses asked me to send them a video, something uplifting for their team meeting during the last lockdown.
Oh, right.
That was a really fun thing to do. And yeah. You know, it felt, you know, I felt very strongly about supporting all the medical people who are, you know, doing such a great job for us. That sort of thing is easy because it was very on brand. Mm. I think if it's true to you, then, you know, it comes across in the right way.
Yeah. And I think, and again, that just comes back to that whole authenticity thing. And I really like, it's really interesting what you just said about you don't have to share everything, but what you do share, make sure it's you and make sure it's real. So there's some really good hints there. You had that successful career, but you stopped it to concentrate solely on your riding, I believe. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
And how was that an easy transition to make, or how did you go about making that switch?
No, I was terrified. So, it wasn't even really a very active decision. So what happened was I had a job that was based in London, and the company I was working for were bought out by Americans, and the job moved to the States.
Right.
And I had moved into a house with a yard on site, and there was somebody else managing the yard, and it was his business, and that lease was coming to an end. And at the same time, my father was very ill and passed away. And my husband said to me, you need to stop, Tamsin, because actually you're not going to go to New York and do this job because we've just about managed to get the horses at home. And you need to have a year out and reconfigure the yard and sort everything out before you go back to your proper grown-up job. And you're doing really well with your riding and with dressage and getting on the team. I think you should focus on that for a year while you just take stock. And I thought, well, you know, that seems a very sensible idea. I'm tired and it's been stressful and I've got quite a lot to sort out. So I'll do that for a year. And that year's gone on for about 7 years. I keep promising him I will go and get a proper job soon. I think he's starting to doubt me. So it wasn't really an active decision. It happened. Yeah. And then as soon as it happened, it changed our lifestyle and it was definitely the right thing to do for me. I've never been happier.
Excellent. And that's quite important, isn't it? Especially in a year like this, to find your happiness. How has COVID 2020 been for you? You've obviously missed competitions, but how's it been for you generally?
Like everybody, I think I've had my ups and downs. I'm lucky because my horses are on site. So,
yeah.
And my job is on site too, because, you know, it's a yard and the horses still poo every day and need mucking out, and they still need feeding every day and they still need working every day. So I'm very lucky from that point of view, because I can be near them and we have space to be able to ride, and I can walk the dog across the field. So even if you can't go very far, I can still be outside. So I have a lot to be grateful for. And I've still got clients coming in to ride in the yard. And at the moment with lockdown, they're on rota, which is slightly more tricky because we all have to be very disciplined about who's going indoors when and who's going outdoors and making sure we don't have too many people on site. But in comparison to lots of people, I'm incredibly lucky.
And we hear talk, obviously you ride for Ireland, but you're based in the UK. And we hear talk about vaccines and, you know, things getting better as we go into the new year. Do you have any thoughts yet on what your competition or your training or your regime may be in the new year?
I have no idea yet. It depends a little bit on what the Irish team would like me to do.
Yeah.
I've got two horses that are going really well. I was supposed to be going up the road just to do a local, get in the arena and remember how to get up the centre line.
Yeah.
That's been cancelled. So I think it's a wait and see. I think it's reasonably likely that some of the earlier competitions in the year will be cancelled on the basis that if there's a vaccine coming, it seems to be make sense to keep everybody as safe as possible until we get to a point where enough people are vaccinated and it's a much safer environment for everybody.
Yeah.
But we wait and see.
I know, it's such a waiting game, isn't it? And, you know, obviously this is Para Dressage Podcast. We are still assuming that there will be a Paralympic Games next year, hopefully, particularly with this news of vaccines. Ireland has currently qualified two spots for two individual riders to compete at that Paralympics. What would it mean? Obviously, there's a lot to go through between now and then, but if you were selected to represent your country at a Paralympics, what would that mean to you?
I'd be lying if I didn't say it was an ultimate dream. It was part of the reason that I gave up my job to run a yard and to ride. And, you know, it would mean the world to me. It's one of those things that motivates you to get up very early in the morning and to train and to do the strength and conditioning training and to work hard. And I'm a goal-orientated person. So there are a lot of goals, as you say, between here and there. But all my sub-goals do build to that. So I have my fingers crossed.
Absolutely fingers crossed for you and everyone, really, as we go into next year, that will be competing and trying to get those qualifying spots. It's going to be fascinating to watch how this all falls out over the next 6 or 7 months as we go into to 2021 in the spring and the build-up to the Games. If indeed they do happen, fingers crossed they do.
Well, I think it could be one of the best games ever, because I think by the time we get there, if they're able to run, everybody is going to need a reason to celebrate
and absolutely
to remind ourselves of why we work hard.
I think it's there is a little part of me that's very optimistic, and I do tend to go for a bit of the kind of the poetic feel about things, but there would be a real symbolism if the first event that we could do globally in a post-COVID world, i.e. we've been vaccinated and the protocols are in place to keep us safe, but wouldn't the Olympics and the Paralympics just be the best reopening of the world if they happened? It would just be magical. It'd be so magical if it happened. But
and it's the right spirit, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. It is. Because, I mean, the one thing I've always loved about the Olympics and the Paralympics is just that sense of the world coming together for 2 weeks of fun, basically, and fairness and fair play and all that kind of stuff. There is a symbolism and a poetry to it, which is just intoxicating when you're part of it, and when you watch it, it's got, you know, the added bonus of sport, but it's just the idea of the world in one city is just brilliant to see and be a part of. So, you know, that's good luck to all of us that hope we can get there. It's excellent. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to let you go. We've covered off some really good tips there. I hope people have found that useful. So thank you for that. The usual message from me, you know, Spotify, iTunes, the website, subscribe, tell your friends, give us feedback, all that kind of thing. But Tamsin, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
And thanks for all your support with all of this. And the plinky plonky music is coming along, and we will see you next time. Thanks ever so much, Tamsin.
Thank you.